Turn to the book of Numbers, chapter 13. Book of Numbers, chapter 13. And let us pray for a moment. Thank you for this time, Father, for being able to have before each of our minds a written representation, description of your truth, and a history of your people and a history of your dealings with people. Lord, I know that you will do all that you can with the conditions of the hearts that are here. If there's good soil, Lord, I know you will plant more seed and produce more fruit. And I pray, Lord, that others will become good soil by a willingness to look and to hear and to see and believe. Pray, Lord, that you'll be with the one who is instructing the children, that they will themselves be affected through the truth, brought into discipline to the truth, and have confidence in you, and learn to have faith in God. Pray for the very young babies, Father, that they would be rested and quieted and settled. Pray that our minds would be greatly alerted and enlivened. Father, be gracious this morning and have your Spirit afresh quicken our minds. In Jesus' name I ask. Amen. If you would like some guidelines to do some studies this week, I have some recommendations. You might write them down. One is in the book of Hebrews, chapters 3 and 4. Sometimes, until discipline is developed, a person may say, gee, I don't know where to go to study. Nothing comes to mind as to what to study or to read. But here's some recommendations. Hebrews chapters 3 and 4. We read a portion of them this morning. Psalm 78. 1 Corinthians 10. Approximately the first 15 or 20 verses. You'll see what I mean by that. And Acts, the 7th chapter. These all have something in common. And as you read them, you'll see that they all have something in common in what they're talking about. And you'll see the fact that they're mentioned 4 different times, and not the only times that they're mentioned, but they're very significant in these 4 different times, gives weight to the importance of the subject matter. In Numbers chapter 13, we have the account of what is known as the 12 spies going into the land, promised land, and spying out the land. And their report and the response to the report. I'm going to read as our text from chapter 14, but I'm going to be using in reference chapter 13, beginning with verses 27 into chapter 14. But in chapter 14 it says, "And Joshua the son of Nun and Caleb the son of Jephunneh, of those who had spied out the land, tore their clothes. And they spoke to all the congregation of the sons of Israel, saying, the land which we passed through to spy out is an exceeding good land. If the Lord is pleased with us, then he will bring us into this land and give it to us, a land which flows with milk and honey. Only do not rebel against the Lord, and do not fear the people of the land, for they shall be our prey. Their protection has been removed from them, and the Lord is with us. Do not fear them." But all the congregation said to stone them with stones. Then the glory of the Lord appeared in the tent of meeting to all the sons of Israel. It's difficult for me to preach on this passage without wanting to bring in a lot of text, because it is a flowing story. It's not a parable self-contained, but it flows from the past events into this event and continues on after the verses that I have even read. And so it's trying to freeze frame, if you will, an activity in the midst of a whole. It's like trying to put an instant replay on just a portion of the whole thing that happened in the last hours and such in the nation of Israel, perhaps even days. I remember growing up and sitting in church and into my youth, hearing the story of the 12 spies that went into the promised land. Remember that? And 2 of them believed, and 10 did not believe. 10 of them gave a bad report, 2 of them gave a good report. I remember the story of the children of Israel, the descendants of Jacob, his name was changed to Israel, being described as wandering 40 years to the wilderness until they came into the promised land. And I don't know why, but all of my life until about 8 years ago, I thought that Israel came out of Egypt, and you may think this too, Israel came out of Egypt through the Red Sea at the direction of Moses and God's miracles, wandered for 40 years, came to the promised land, sent out the 12 spies. 2 of the good spies said, we can take it, and they were hid by Rahab in her house. And then they came back and reported they can take the land, and they crossed over and took Jericho and started taking the land. Now how many think that's what happened? Some think that, see. Well, that's not what happened. And it shocked me to find out the truth. The truth of the matter is, when they left Egypt under Moses' guidance and the miracles of God, they traveled for about 6 months and came to Mount Sinai. At Mount Sinai, God revealed His law and His grace, by the way. You can look into that yourself. But He revealed both very strongly, as equally as strong. Then, after they left Mount Sinai, they traveled for about another year, stopping and starting, until they got to the Promised Land. Then is when they sent out the 12 spies. And then is when, after 40 days of spying, they came back and 10 said, there are giants in the land, there are fortified cities in the land, there are many peoples in the land, we can't take it. And the 2 spies, Joshua and Caleb, said, we can take it. And because they refused to believe God, God pronounced judgment upon that generation and caused them to wander 1 year for every day they had spied out the land, which meant they turned around and wandered for 40 years after that. Then after that generation, anyone over the age of 20 died off, he brought them back to the promised land. And that generation, under Joshua's leadership and Caleb's leadership of faith, crossed the Jordan and destroyed Jericho and began to take the land. I had never known that. They had gotten to the land and then wandered for 40 years. I could never understand why, if they left Egypt, it took them 40 years to get to the promised land. I just thought they didn't have a good sense of direction. You know, you're out there in the desert and you can't tell. There's no signs or anything. Or that it was very, very, very far. Then I got into Bible school and I got a hold of some maps and things and began to look at it, and it's only 200 miles. And you can travel that as they did in 18 months. See? The reason they wandered for 40 years is because God judged them, not because they couldn't find the place. So after the wandering of 40 years is the book of Joshua begins, and they enter into the promised land and receive what was promised. But what we're going to look at this morning is that incident that which took place when they first got to the promised land and when they sent out the 12 spies and when the 12 spies came back and their report and what it produced. What was the result of that? Okay? Which resulted in them being judged and wandering for 40 years. In chapter 13, you will see that verses 27 through 29, starting with verse 27 through 29, is the report of the 12 spies. Is the report of the 12 spies. All 12 reported, starting with verse 27. We went into the land where you sent us, and it certainly does flow with milk and honey. And this is its fruit. And they held up these large clusters of grapes and figs and stuff that they had brought back. Nevertheless, the people who live in the land are strong, and the cities are fortified and very large. And moreover, we saw the descendants of Enoch there. Now, Enoch, it was revealed earlier, and his sons were giants, large of stature people, which would give you a natural response of intimidation, physically speaking. Okay. Amalek is living in the land of the Negev, that's the southern desert, and the Hittites and the Jebusites and the Amorites, three different cultures, are living in the hill country, and the Canaanites are living by the sea and by the side of the Jordan. In other words, there's already people there in our land, many of them. Now, apparently, this report given by all 12 spies began to ruffle the concerns of the people that were listening. Because it says, then Caleb quieted the people. So there must have been some speaking out and some concerns being expressed. Then Caleb quieted the people before Moses and said, "We should by all means go up and take possession of it, for we shall surely overcome it." Wonderful. Good report. Okay? But the men who had gone up with him said, "We are not able to go up against the people, for they are too strong for us." Now you've got two conflicting reports. 12 men who had seen the same thing, and one says, "We can by all means take it." And 10, we find out it is 10, because Joshua agreed with Caleb. 10 said, seeing the same thing, "We cannot take it." Now who's right? Which is true? Can they both be speaking the truth? They are both drawing from the same thing that they saw, but are they both speaking the truth? Listen to the results of the reports of the 10. So they gave out to the sons of Israel a bad report of the land which they had spied out, saying, here's some more of the report, "The land through which we have gone in spying it out is a land that devours its inhabitants. It eats up those who come in. And all the people whom we saw in it are men of great size. There also we saw the Nephilim. The sons of Anak are part of the Nephilim. And we became like grasshoppers in our own sight, and so we were in their sight." And they're reporting the size difference between them and the people that were living in the land, and the large number of people living in the land, as well as their size. And this is a country that eats its visitors, is what it's saying. Now look at the results, the influence upon the people. Verse 1, chapter 14. "Then all the congregation lifted up their voices and cried, and the people wept that night." What were they weeping for? "And all the sons of Israel grumbled against Moses and Aaron. And the whole congregation said to them, 'Would that we had died in the land of Egypt, or would that we had died in this wilderness. And why is the Lord bringing us into this land to fall by the sword? Our wives and our little ones will become plunder. Would it not be better for us to return to Egypt?' So they said to one another, 'Let us appoint a leader and return to Egypt.' Then Moses and Aaron fell on their faces in the presence of all the assembly of the congregation of the sons of Israel." And then Joshua delivers his sermon after that, that we read as a text, trying to encourage the people that certainly the land can be taken. I want to point out from this some significant truths that are laying upon it and that were in operation at the time. The people believed the report of the 10. We've been talking about faith for the last couple of weeks. We've been on Hebrews chapter 11, verse 6, that says, "Without faith it is impossible to please Him." Notice Joshua's sermon when he gets down to verse 8. "If the Lord is pleased with us, then He will bring us into this land." Without faith it is impossible to please Him. We will see here, and it is on the face of it, that the reason God judged them is because of unbelief. They did not please Him. And He specifically tells us it's unbelief as to why they did not have the land and they were sent back into the wilderness. 10 men said, we cannot take the land. Now, who are these 10 men? There were 12 children of a man named Jacob. His name was changed to Israel. His descendants were later called the children of Israel. It doesn't mean they were all children. It just meant they're the descendants of Israel. Each of these sons was considered a tribe of this man. So there was 12 tribes in Israel. Each of the tribes, in order to have a consistent and good government over them, oftentimes each tribe would send a representative or representatives when things were decided, and then those leaders would go back to that tribe and convey the information, so that Moses would rule and pass on information in God's will through leadership so that the word could be passed on to each tribe and then into each home. He didn't stand there and have a voice that could be heard by 3 million people, because that's about how many there were there. So when they went to spy out the land, it was decided that each tribe would select a person to represent the tribe so that each tribe could have a representative and come back and report to their tribe according to what was seen. So that's why there are 12 spies. In fact, their names are in chapter 13. Each tribe sent a representative, and his name was recorded in chapter 13 for the whole world to know now what their report is and what. They were a leader. Out of perhaps 300,000 people in each tribe, one person was selected. And they, I don't believe that they drew lots, but there was a person believed to be confident enough to bring back an evaluation, that it was a person known in the community, in the tribe, and he was picked as a person to go down and be responsible to bring back a truthful report. And 10 of them said they cannot take the land, and they were believed instead of the 2. But what was the truth of the matter? Was it true that they cannot take the land? Where did they get that truth? If they were being truthful, where did they get the truth that they can't take the land? It is true that there were 5 civilizations living in the land that was promised them. It is true that they were giants in some of those civilizations. It is true that there was a great population there and there was fortified cities there. That is all true. Nobody questions that. Joshua and Caleb confirmed the same thing. That is all true. But now they say it is true we cannot take the land. Where did they get that truth? And the people decided to believe them. The people were not compelled to believe them. There was no necessary reason to believe them, but they decided to believe them. Why did they decide to believe them? Why was their testimony according to the truth? And why was Joshua and Caleb considered liars? Because Joshua and Caleb said, we can certainly take the land. In fact, in verse 9, he says, only do not rebel against the Lord, and do not fear the people of the land, for they shall be our prey. We shall eat them for lunch, as we would say in certain circles of macho men, right? We eat Canaanites for lunch. Instead of that being a land that devours its visitors, we shall devour them. But the people would not believe them, so they were considered liars. In fact, they even decided to stone Joshua and Caleb because Joshua and Caleb continued to preach that they could take the land. But the people had decided to believe the 10. One reason that they decided to believe the 10, because they were the 10. How could 10 people possibly be wrong out of 12? How could 10 out of 12 people possibly not see the truth of a matter? So they must be telling us the truth. Because there's so many who say that that is true. The influence and force of the majority has great influence upon people's minds. What most people believe is what people think is true, otherwise most people wouldn't believe it. It is of great influence upon people's minds. How could it possibly be true that God saves us not only from hell and guilt, but also from sin in this world, if most of the people who profess to be Christians don't believe that? It can't possibly be true that God can really save us from the bondage of sin in this world, because most Christians don't believe that, and most preachers don't believe that. So it can't be true. Ergo, or therefore, since 10 out of 12 preachers do not preach that God can save us from sin in this world, it therefore can't be true that God can save us from sin in this world. Well, I've listened to preachers, and I've read books, and I've listened to other people, and they've told me the great giants that they face, the great strength of lust in their life, the great strength of greed in their lives, the great strength of their selfishness. And they tell me that. And how can I possibly say that they're not telling me the truth, because they tell me this great obstacle that they face and this great sin that they can't overcome. And I can't call them a liar. But Joshua didn't say that there weren't giants there. And Joshua didn't say that there weren't fortified cities there. And Joshua didn't say that there weren't other cultures there that had to be conquered. That was not the issue. The issue is not to deny that people are facing great enemies of their soul and are in bondage to them, and there's great strength in temptation, there's great strength in desires, there's great strength in emotions. That's not how to overcome sin, is to deny what is really true about our constitutions and about the world in which we live in and the strength of the devil and his temptation. That's not the pathway out of sin. It is to look those things straight in the face and acknowledge their full strength and to full the degree to which they operate in this world and to which they operate in our beings, and then to go to the Scriptures and see if God has honestly portrayed an answer to those in their full strength. Is there full enough grace to overcome the full strength of temptation and desires and lusts and feelings? That's the question. And we need to see the answer, each one for ourselves. If God has not made the provision, we need to know it. Let's stop kidding ourselves. Let's stop fooling around. Let's stop saying something that's not true. If God has not made that provision, we need to know it. Let's get into it. Let's find out. And if He has, then let's find out and let us live accordingly. So people say, preachers say, and writers say, and the majority say, and 10 out of 12 may say, there's these giants in the land. There's these giants of sin, and giants of lust, and giants of greed, and giants of covetousness, and I have not overcome them in my life, therefore they cannot be overcome in this life. And when so many raise their voices and testify to the same thing, it lends strength that must be true. But that is not where Joshua and Caleb drew the line as to what was. And what the ten concluded was not what was based upon what was true. They drew a conclusion that they could not take the land, not because they didn't see what they saw. They did see what they saw, but they left out something. They left out something that can't be seen. They left out the truth that can't be seen with the eye, heard with the ear, felt with the finger. Can be heard with the ear, excuse me. They left out a truth that is not in this physical world that they took into account. But Joshua and Caleb did not leave out a truth. They factored it in so that when they gave their report, it was consistent with the truth of what they saw and the truth of that which is, but which is not in this material world. They were speaking according to all of the truth. They were believing all that was true in the matter. And that's why their report was different. So we have the majority opinion. People say, well, how many believe what you believe? Are there a lot of people who believe what you believe? Are there a lot of people that agree with your opinion? What's the basis of that question? Because the answer to them would be, if there are a lot of people, then it might be true. But if there are not many people, then that proves it's not true. And it doesn't prove it's true, or doesn't prove it's not true. If we had a church with 1,000 people, it wouldn't prove that I'm preaching the truth. Some people think now that I'm pastor of a church that can be identified somewhere, that I must now be one who is speaking the truth, because pastors do speak the truth. Therefore, I must be speaking the truth because now I am a pastor. One of the difficulties in sharing my testimony and sharing with other people prior to being pastor here is that I wasn't a pastor anywhere, therefore I had no legitimacy in expressing my views. And since our pastor says that can't be true, then it can't be true. If I could, and I could show you, multitudes of people, particularly from the 19th century, who wrote and expressed the same views that you have been hearing here for the last couple of years, and who testified to live in the truth of them. I could name you William and Catherine Booth, who were Methodists, who broke off, or didn't break off, they didn't divide, they simply established a work God called them to, called the Salvation Army, who taught exactly the same thing that you are hearing and have been hearing. I can talk to you about Daniel Steele. I can talk to you about Brengel. I can talk to you about Mr. Hills, professors in seminaries who taught their students, who became ministers, the same thing that you've been hearing. That the gospel is a gospel of deliverance from sin, not just from guilt and not just from hell. Oh, that's exciting, Dennis, and I can make a whole list of people. Demonstrate it to you. But that wouldn't prove it is true. It would not alleviate the reasons for you not to believe it, because it's got to be believed on the basis of truth other than how many people believe it. Two people at the beginning of creation believed that God was benevolent and all things that they needed for their necessities of life He had provided for them. At some point in time, 100% of those people stopped believing that. But it didn't make it not true. When Adam and Eve stopped believing in God, 100% went from believing God to not believing God, but it didn't change the fact that God is trustworthy and should be believed, and there's reasons to trust Him. And in this case here, the whole nation in their unbelief refused to enter into what God had promised. That didn't mean that God's promises weren't true, or that He was not able to perform His promises, or that He was not willing to perform His promises. It didn't negate the truth. It only destroyed them. It didn't destroy God. It didn't change God. It didn't change the truth. It didn't change God's character when He is not believed. The only person it changes is the unbeliever. So, you know, the temptation is to respond to people's unbelief when they trust in the majority by trying to give evidence of how many people have believed the same thing. But that's just an appeal to the other side, and that would only induce them into them a belief based upon who believes it and how many believe it, and not whether it's true. There are many people who want to belong to a religion that is on the move and is going to win. And they are susceptible to falling in with those who can present the idea, this is the movement of God, and this is the winning, victorious movement of God, and this is the place where God's victories come about, and Get in here because this is God's place for the hour. And they want to be part of something that's winning. And they're willing to give and work because they think they're on the winning side. And the faith is based upon that they think it's the winning side, not that it is true. There have been numerous times in the history of the church when those that we now acknowledge were standing up for the truth that were not in the majority. Martin Luther is acknowledged historically as having tapped into and seen a truth of justification by faith alone without works of personal righteousness as the reason God justifies man. And we look back at him and say he saw a truth and he stood by it and he was a majority of one as far as the truth goes. But as far as the church went at the time, he was a minority of one. So how many people believe something has nothing to do with affirming or disaffirming if it's true? Got to look to other things. You can't look at who believes it. You can't look at authority. You can't look at the fact that not only were there 10 who believed that they couldn't take the land, but you can't look at the fact that they were each a leader of a tribe, and therefore, because they had this authority, they must in fact known that this was true. You can't look to authority and say authority makes something true, because it doesn't. God, because of his authority, cannot declare something to be true that is not and make it true. God cannot declare that the sinner who continues in his sin, even though he confesses them, is now justified and accepted in his sight. He cannot do that. God, by his authority, cannot make sin holiness and holiness sin. He cannot declare the Ten Commandments to no longer be in force by his authority. His authority cannot change some things that are true in and of themselves. His authority can't change it just because he says so. But the influence of authority influences many people's minds so that if certain people say such and such is true, they are willing to believe it is true, even if it's not. And that is all they need to hear is, so and so says it is true. And their faith is not based, therefore, on the truth, but on authority. If you base your faith on the fact that I say something is true without you yourself following along in my thoughts and see it for yourself, your faith will not take you very far. You'll find yourself stumbling and you'll find yourself skeptical, and then you'll think it is the truth that is not the truth, rather than understanding that you are basing your faith on my confidence or my authority. However you may perceive that. But that won't sustain you. You cannot base your faith on the view that I am persuaded it is true. Because that won't carry you. It just won't carry you. So authority, some people are very influenced by, and they will yield to that and decide to believe that that is true because of who says it so. That is the foundation of Roman Catholicism. Authority decides what is true over and above something being true in and of itself. So authority can say such and such is true, and therefore we have to believe it because it has been said by authority. But authority doesn't create truth, and thank God authority can't destroy truth. Thank God majority and authority cannot destroy the truth regarding God and his character and his promises. Thank God for that. Then you have the minority. The minority, in this case, representative of oftentimes the cases where the minority is one who has seen the truth, has believed the truth, is ready to act on the truth, is ready to declare the truth, is ready to call other people to see the truth and believe the truth, and they are faced with being the minority and being, in one fashion or another, the target of stones. That when God brings a revival, it always starts with a minority. On the day of Pentecost, it was a minority of 120 compared to all of the people that were in Jerusalem at the time. When God is going to bring promises to pass, He starts with an individual or several who have sought the Lord together or several who have are in faith, seeing God's promises and seeing what the obstacles are and knowing God has promised in spite of the obstacles to bring certain things to pass and certain things that are true. And they believe upon them and God brings them to pass, and then all of a sudden God has created a minority that is confronted and does confront against the majority. But there's one thing about having seen the truth and believed it. Once you have seen the truth and believed it, nobody can take it away. Once the person has tasted and seen that the Lord is good, nobody can persuade them the Lord is not good. Once somebody has tasted of the death of Christ and found themselves to be crucified with Christ, and at the same time have tasted of His resurrection, and they know that they live, yet they don't live, but Christ lives in them, nobody can persuade them that they can't die to sin and live unto God. Once that has occurred, nobody can persuade them that it is impossible for a person to not live in bondage to sin. That it is possible thereafter to escape the bondage of sin. Once you've tasted that the Lord is good, nobody can persuade you that He's not. And Joshua and Caleb were persuaded because they had faith. Now somebody might have pointed out and said, okay, Joshua was the guy who went up on Mount Sinai with Moses. And he did. You read in the fine print, if you get back there in Exodus 30, 31, 32, that when Moses went up, he took some of his leaders up with him certain distance. And apparently Joshua went with him. Because it says when Moses left, Joshua stayed behind. Joshua was up there with him. Joshua used to follow Moses around. He used to be in the tent of meeting when the glory would come down. And it would say that Moses would leave and Joshua would remain behind. People could say, well, you know, Joshua is just trying to take Moses' place. So he's trying to talk like Moses. He's trying to talk faith. He's trying to talk people into going in. He's trying to be like Moses because he wants to take his place. We can't trust this guy because he has an ulterior motive. And we can't trust Caleb because he's one of those kind of people that just sort of, you know, will follow somebody. He's a follower. So we've got somebody that's trying to take Moses' place, trying to groom himself for Moses' place. We've got Caleb who will just, you know, he likes the idea of being associated with popular people or famous people or people with authority or whatever. So we can't believe those two. And it's easy to try to destroy the credibility of a minority because there's only a few targets and you only have to destroy the credibility of a few. And that's pretty easy to do. You can pick and choose and destroy their reputation. So they had their plans to destroy the minority, and the ultimate plan was to destroy them literally by stoning them to death. There are two excuses offered here that I think we will get into next week, perhaps on Wednesday. One is in verse 31 of chapter 13. We are not able to go up against the people. Their first excuse was inability. We are not able to do it. Inability. God has promised us His plan. He has brought us by miracle after miracle after miracle right here so we can take it. But we can't take it. Almost as if to say, we crossed the Red Sea, we provided manna for ourselves, and we provided water out of the rock, but this is just too hard for us now. As though they did everything before it themselves. But this is it. We can bring water out of rock, and we can bring manna out of the sky, and we can cross Red Seas, but we just can't take giants. Maybe that was going through their mind. Well, I won't get into that. Second excuse is found in chapter 14, verse 3. Chapter 14, verse 3. Why is the Lord bringing us into this land to fall by the sword? Our wives and our little ones will become plunder. Oh, God is going to destroy the innocent. Why would God be such a kind of a being that He would bring us here to destroy the innocent, the wives and the children? Oh, the children! Such feigned concern for the children. It's just an excuse, and I'll develop that at another time. But I do want to develop further is the difference between the faith of the unbeliever and the faith of the believer. The unbelief of the unbeliever and the belief of the believer. The ten were believers. They believed they could not take the land. Joshua and Caleb were believers. And they believed that they could take the land. Then why do I call, why do I say that the unbelievers had faith? Faith of the unbelievers included the active belief that there were giants in the land, included the active faith, according to the truth, that there were people in the land and civilizations. It included, based upon the truth, that there were cities and fortified cities in the land. All of that is legitimate faith. But their faith was filled with non-faith because it didn't take in all of the truth. Here is more of the truth that they were not willing to believe. Chapter 14, verse 16. Moses is now praying for God to forgive them for their disobedience and unbelief. And in his prayer, he reveals what is true and has always been known to be true. Because he says to the Lord, because, and this is what people will say if you don't, if you do destroy them, this is what people will say, the nations will say, because the Lord could not bring this people into the land which he promised them by oath. The unbelieving ten did not believe the whole truth, because more of the truth than what was there is that God had promised with an oath to Abraham, he promised again to Isaac, he promised again to Jacob that their descendants would be given this land. But they didn't believe what God had promised and what they knew God had promised. They had knowledge that God had promised with an oath. God raised his hand and swore, I will give to your descendants this land. They knew that. The second truth that they did not take into account is in verse 11. And the Lord said to Moses, how long will this people spurn me? And how long will they not believe in me, despite all the signs which I have performed in their midst? God had already demonstrated numerous signs of power, demonstrating his ability to overcome every obstacle. Their food, their water, their shelter, their warmth, the Red Sea, the armies of Pharaoh. He dealt with each of those with remarkable power, so that he demonstrated that he had the ability to remove physical obstacles, prevent physical attacks, overcome physical lakes and rivers, to overcome the need for food for 3 million people every day, to provide water for 3 million people every day. That can be appreciated if you're reading your papers at all with what's going on in Rwanda, where there's 500,000 people in one place and there's only 50,000 gallons of water per day. That's about a cup a person. These people of Israel had sufficient water out of the rock. They had sufficient manna every day. God had demonstrated His ability, so that when they saw the giants and they saw the cities and they saw the peoples, God's ability had already been shown that He could take care of those things. But they wouldn't believe what they had already seen. Secondly, they would not believe His character. Because He promised with an oath. He swore to give them the land. So that when they were there, and when they saw what they saw, which was all true, they did not continue to add to their thinking the truth that God had promised. So they chose not to believe that. It was already known to them. They were not ignorant. Unbelief is not ignorance. Unbelief is the willingness not to take into account what is revealed by God about Himself, what He has promised. So the unbelief of these unbelievers was the refusal to believe all that was true regarding the case. They believed in His power. They said, we cannot. Now here's the interesting thing about... Here's something that I want everyone to continue following me on and think hard on. Because the unbeliever offers his unbelief as the reason for not believing. The unbeliever offers as his reason for not believing the fact that he does not believe. I had breakfast with a gentleman that was introduced to me through a mutual friend. This is a couple years ago. And through this, the mutual friend that I have, and I led him into the understanding of God's mercy, the understanding of what it means to love God with all your heart, that we all can do that, and he began to reflect upon that, and he saw that he was not doing that. He saw as a result he was living in sin and disobedience. And he sought out and found the mercy of God and gave his whole heart to love God supremely. And he does to this day, and he's brought his whole family, and it's a marvelous thing. He had a friend who began to hear about this sort of thing. And he introduced me, and I met him at a breakfast meeting. See the possibility of meeting together. And so as we were talking, he complained. He says, well, you know, I don't know much about you, but I do have a lot of confidence and so on and so. And he says some things of confidence regarding yourself, so I'm here to listen to what you have to say. And in the course of the conversation, he says, well, one of the things that really bothers me about the church is that there's so many hypocrites in it. As I understand. We kept on talking, and then I began to share with him what I had shared with his friend and some of the basis of it and what it was going to be about if we were to get together. And I laid out to him that we all can love God with all of our heart, that we all must love God with all of our heart, we're able to do so, and we're required to do so, and these are the things where we're going to start. And after talking about it, back and forth about it, he, near the end of the conversation, he says, oh, that all sounds very good, this all sounds very interesting and such, but he says, I just don't believe that that is possible. And I said, that is the very thing we are going to talk about. The fact that you don't believe it is possible, and I'm going to show you it is. And right then he understood what I was saying. The issue was whether or not he was believing the truth. Was his belief that it was not possible valid, or just what he chose to believe, based upon authority, or majority, or what? He saw the issue was he believing what was true? And did his not believing what I said make what I said not true? And he saw what the issue was. He offered to me the reason for his non-living of it, his unbelief in it, is because he didn't believe it was true. Therefore, he didn't believe it. You see the redundancy in that? He offered to me and said, I don't believe it's possible because I don't believe it's possible. He offered to me as his reason for not believing it that he didn't believe it. The reason that these 10 men didn't believe they could have the land is because we don't believe we can have the land. And the unbeliever rests his strength upon the fact and the strength of his not believing something. And if you say to the unbeliever, what is a good reason why you don't believe it?
Because I just don't believe it.
And that is a sufficient reason to the unbeliever to continue on and keep themselves in that state. The fact that they strongly believe it and they're conscious that they believe it is offered as the reason why they don't believe it. The issue is not, do you believe it or not believe it? The issue is it true? There's no justification for not believing something because you don't believe it. That doesn't justify unbelief. The fact that you are conscious that you, in fact, don't believe something doesn't mean that that is not true or is true. There has to be better evidence and reason for saying, I don't believe something is true, than simply offer, well, I've looked over my mind and my thinking and I don't believe it's true, therefore, it's not true. And to give that as the grounds upon which to remain with the mind closed and inactive and not taking action upon what is true. I don't know if that sounds clear enough to you to convey what I'm trying to convey. It's one more excuse to remain where a person is. Why don't you change? Because I don't believe it's true. Is that any reason? You can't offer your unbelief as a reason. You've got to go beyond it and say, I don't believe this is true because if that were true, it would contradict what God reveals about His Word. I don't believe that is true because it contradicts a promise. I don't believe that is true because it would praise sin. I don't believe that is true because you can't offer just, I don't believe it is true as the bottom sufficient reason for not believing it is true. Neither can a person legitimately say, I believe it is true, without saying, I believe it is true because it would necessarily reflect the character of God, it is revealed in a promise of God, it is according to His character, it is according to the truth of His creation, it is according to the truth of this or that, it is according to truth. But to simply say, I believe it, therefore it is true, is not sufficient either. Entire sanctification is not true because I believe it. It is not true that they couldn't take the land because 10 men said, I believe we can't take the land, therefore it's true. What men choose to believe or not believe does not create or destroy what is true. That is why they were held guilty for not believing that God had promised them and would bring them and give them the land at that point in time. They were held guilty because their unwillingness to believe was a decision, not based upon the truth, but based upon their fear. They had no less certainty in their decision. Get that. Their decision wasn't just
over the edge into a decision, and it could be changed easily because they were so uncertain about things. It wasn't ignorance, and it wasn't, they weren't just uncertain. They were certain that they couldn't take the land. Their commitment to believing that they could not take the land was a certain commitment. So if you were to ask them and say, are you really committed to that? They wouldn't say, well, no. They would say, I'm certain of it. Therefore, from that standpoint, therefore it's true. We can't take the land because I'm certain. But being certain about something doesn't mean it's true unless you offer the reasons why you're certain. I am certain we can't take the land because God hasn't promised us. God hasn't shown He's able to give it to us. I don't know enough about His character to believe that He'll do it. You have to have some kind of reasons like that. And when somebody preaches that the gospel, when believed, is the power of God into salvation, and it brings a person out of sin into salvation, out of darkness into light, out of bondage into liberty, because God promised it. Because Jesus came to save His people from their sins. Because God came to destroy the works of the devil. Because God is holy and He cannot commune with those who do not have the same character as Him. Because God is not pleased with anybody that doesn't trust Him. You've got to have reasons to affirm that it is true that the gospel does certain things. But to simply say, I believe it, doesn't affirm it, and doesn't make it true. And for somebody simply to say with conviction, I don't believe it, therefore it's not true. No, that's not a basis for it. But it's amazing to my mind that people will offer their unbelief as a justification for not believing, is what it amounts to. And just a couple of examples of something to close up. Peter is a fisherman. And there was a time in which he fished all night and caught nothing. You remember the story? And he saw Jesus on the shore. They encountered each other. And Jesus said, now go out in the boat and throw your net down on the other side of the boat. This doesn't sound real rational, does it? Like it would make any difference which side of the boat you would fish on the lake. Go out, Peter, and throw your net down on the other side of the boat than you were fishing on, and you'll catch more than you can handle. And Peter said, Lord, we have fished all night. Nevertheless, at your word, we will do it. Peter knew he fished all night. Peter knew he caught nothing, he said. But he took into account one more truth, and that is God had said to do something. So, factoring in this new knowledge that had been imparted to him, that Jesus was saying, do it, he acted on it, he was willing to believe it, not just that he had tried it, not just that he hadn't succeeded, but now he took into account this new element that God was speaking. He went out, and they caught more than they could handle. He had to call James and John over to help him keep the boat from turning over, or the fish from tearing the nets. And as soon as they got to the shore, Jesus said, come and follow me, and they left everything to follow Jesus. This is a demonstration that when you take into account only what you've experienced and only what you've seen and decide then that something is impossible, even though God says it is, you are offering your unbelief as a reason for not believing, for disobeying. Paul was gloriously converted to loving God and serving God and being zealous for God and living in holiness before God. But Saul, same person before he was converted, had a zeal for God and a knowledge of God, went around trying to kill people who loved God. And if you talk to him as Saul, he would tell you his certainty that he was serving God. But he factored in something else. He factored in what was true about the Messiah. And when he factored that in and believed that too, he became Paul. His life radically changed, and he denounced everything he did as Saul. Because it was not based upon all the truth that God had revealed, but only what he decided he would believe. and left out other things that were known to him, but he would not believe them. So you would find in case after case, men and women in the Scriptures who would not just stop at what could be seen in this material world, but would go on and add according to what God promised and to their understanding and their belief and God's character, and will live according to that. And when they lived according to that, the lands, the rest, the forgiveness, the liberty came into existence. God gave it. God gives it to people who add to their knowledge what is true about Him and believe all the truth that there is, and not just selectively, just what they can see. Do not let your unbelief be the reason why you don't believe. Let your belief be based not on that Dennis believes it, or that Dennis has some authority, or that a whole bunch of people have believed it before, or even if I said, look at all the people in the Bible believed it. They believed it because it was true. You've got to see the truth upon which that is based, and the God who promised it, His character. You've got to have reasons for your faith. Because you do have, if you're in unbelief, reasons for your unbelief. And you'll go from unbelief to belief when you're willing to take in the truths that give you reasons to believe. Let's pray. Father, I pray that you take this message this morning, an example of the occasion here, and cause us to see and turn away from a reason to believe that it's because a person has authority, because most of the people believe it, or because our obstacles are great, that sin's power is great, therefore it cannot be overcome. Help us, Lord, to turn away from thinking like that. I pray that every person here will see the reasonableness of what I said and will act accordingly. They will purify their thinking and purify their hearts according to the truth, and turn away from any influence that continues to bombard us in this world that because so-and-so said it is true, because so many people say it is true, because authority has said it is true, or because the obstacles to be overcome are so great. But Father, may we look at Joshua and Caleb and see two men were captivated by the truth and pronounced it and declared it and called upon others to believe it as well. And those are the only two, Father, that you permitted to live through the 40 years and to enter into the land that they knew you could give them. And Father, you said in your word there yet remains a rest for the people of God who will believe, that those who do believe do enter into your rest. And Father, there may be some who have been wandering in wilderness for years, but it doesn't mean they have to die there, dear Lord. Everyone who will hear the gospel and believe it can enter into your rest. And I pray that every soul shall look beyond the giants of their lust and greed and covetousness and their sin, and build their faith based upon something more than that. That your gospel and promises are equivalent to and greater than sin. You came to destroy the works of the devil. Pray this message will be an uplifter to those who have faith, and a guide to those who are seeking faith, who know they need faith. May it do good to all who have heard. I pray in Jesus' name. Amen. God bless you, church.